Now, if you're a fan of the TV show The Amazing Race, you might have seen that one of the teams in the current season of the show are a couple of nuns from Canberra. Sadly, they were eliminated from the race this week, but it did get me thinking about nuns in the modern world. Who becomes a nun these days? What do they do? Why don't they wear those distinctive habits anymore? And what is their role in a modern church that has had its moral authority in the world undermined by the behaviour of so many of its leaders? For centuries, nuns were healers and educators. Sadly, though, those days are mostly gone, certainly here in Australia. So what do nuns do in Australia in the 21st century? Our guest this morning is Sister Libby Rogerson, who is a Loreto nun. Sister, a very good morning to you.
Thank you, Rod. Good morning to you.
I will say that my sisters and my nieces both went to the school that you've very much been associated with, which is a complete coincidence. Yes.
It's a total coincidence, yes. Well, but I went to it too, so there you are. Yes.
Why did you join the convent?
Oh, my heavens. I think the idea it changes over the time. I guess when I started to think about being a nun, when I was quite young, I think it was somehow to contribute to making the world a better place. I think that was it. I think it was certainly, I felt that this was something, in a pretty vague way at that stage, that God wanted me to do. And, yeah, I think those were probably the two things, really. Yeah.
When did you join? How old were you at the time?
I was almost 25. Yeah, 24.
Is that late for a vocation?
It was then. It isn't now. It was later then, not late. Yeah. I didn't, go straight from school or anything, which some did. Yeah.
But 25 is still pretty young, though, isn't it? I mean, do you think that, or even when, girls left school and went straight to a novitiate or a convent, quite often they're only 17, 18, 19. Are they old enough to make a decision which will have lifelong ramifications?
Well, I don't know that I'd say so now, but it was a different era then. And a lot of people then made that decision and stayed on and were still there and lived very positive and fulfilled lives. So somehow or other they did make the right decision. Some didn't, obviously. Yeah, but it is young, but I think people make decisions when they're young about a lot of other things. We forget that, yeah.
How long does it take to become a nun?
It takes approximately 6 years. You have about 3 years in what we, 2 or 3 years in what we call a novitiate, 3 years, and then you just take vows for 1 or 2 years at a time. That's where you would do further study of one sort or another. Could be university studies or it might be theology or something. And at the end of about 9 years, you then take final vows. That's ones where you promise it for life. Yeah.
So once you've made those final vows, that's it. How difficult is it to leave?
Oh, it's not very difficult. It's not very difficult. The procedure usually is that a person who thinks they want to leave would have a discussion with the person, like the community leader or the leader of the province. They'd have a lot of talks with somebody. They often make a retreat or try to discern what it is. Then they leave, and then there's a formality of signing papers or so on, which go to Rome ultimately, but it's not like you're caged in or something. No.
Are you a nun forever, though? I mean, I've heard many times people say, well, when you're ordained a priest, even if you leave the priesthood, you are a priest forever. Is that the case with nuns as well?
No, it's not. No.
You can leave the convent and that is it. You're no longer a nun.
No, that's the forever bit is associated with ordination. It's not with nuns, no.
Okay. No. So that discussion that you have, perhaps if you're thinking of leaving, not to dwell too much on that, is that a discussion that you also have when you decide to join the convent.
Oh, lots of discussions.
Yeah, tell me about that process, that when you go to the convent and say, look, I'm thinking about becoming a nun, what kind of even psychological testing goes on to make sure that you're the right person for it?
Well, the process would be something like this, and it varies a little bit, but there's usually somebody in the country who is what we call responsible for formation, for the training of sisters and so on. So you'd have a talk with her. You have a whole series of talks with her. Then there's usually a process of, like, more or less come and see, and you might come and stay with, you know, one of the houses for a while, see how the sisters live and what the work is and so on. Then you make a formal application, and then there is psychological testing, there is discussion. Normally you would make some sort of a retreat where you would, you know, have a lot of time to process it and think about it and so on. And then there are people who do psychological testing for sisters, yeah, and other people, yeah.
Mm. How religious do you have to be to become a nun?
Well, I'm not sure that I know what religious is, but you don't have to. I think you have to have a profound sense of God. I think you need to be convinced that following the way of Jesus is what you want to do. I think you have to weigh up what it is about not having marriage or a family or being single, living in a community. You weigh up all those things. But if you mean you have to be very holy and pious, no, the answer is probably less so the better, really.
Really? Why? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we have to be relevant and part of the community and part of the world. And I think probably excessive piety rather cuts you off from that. That's all I mean. But to be a believer in Christ, in Christianity and so on, of course, is absolutely fundamental. And in terms of being a Catholic nun, well, then you adhere to part of what it is to be a Catholic. But it's a very broad spectrum.
Sure. Because there are some orders that are, you'd have to say, more pious than others.
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's no doubt about that. Like, there's some people more pious than others, yes. Yeah, true.
How many Loreto nuns would there be in Australia now, do you think?
I can't tell you. Because we Australia and Southeast Asia, so we have some sisters in Vietnam and just about four in East Timor and a couple in the Philippines. We're about 80-something in total.
And when you joined the order, would you have had any idea of how many were there and how many perhaps were joining alongside you around about the same time that you decided?
I suppose we were well over 100 when I joined. Anyhow, I think we were about 200 probably when I joined, thereabouts. There were about joined with me in my year when I joined. We were six initially, and then down to about three. Yep.
And are you the only one left of those who joined at that time? Are they
No.
All three are still there?
Well, three of us are still there. Mm-hmm. A couple dropped out early and one a bit later and so on. Yep.
Do we have any idea how many nuns there are overall in Australia, just beyond the Loreto Order?
I don't know in numbers. There's about 140-something religious congregations of women. I know that. Okay. I couldn't tell you how many. No.
So what are the differences between the different orders of nuns? Some, for example, of the Loreto nuns would have been teaching nuns. There would have been nursing nuns as well.
Yeah.
There are others that...
Social work.
That's right. So just give us a brief idea of the sorts of different orders, perhaps, and what those orders do.
Well, different orders come out of a particular foundress, whoever it was, who had a particular slant on Christianity and on Catholicism and how they might serve. So there would be sisters such as ourselves whose primary work was education but did other things as well. There were some that were very much into nursing and health. Mercy Sisters did both education and health. Sisters of Charity with the St. Vincent's Hospital were very predominantly towards health. There were other sisters who did a lot of work, like other Daughters of Charity who did social work among the very poor. There were others that were founded specifically to go to other countries, so and did a variety of sort of work there. But among all of those, there were also people engaged in tertiary education, in a whole variety of other things, yeah. But they were predominantly, I guess, historically, in the business of probably teaching, nursing, social work were the major, but not the total.
Okay. Yep. Sister Libby Rogerson is our guest on Overnights this morning as we talk about the life of the modern nun. Bill in Melbourne is with us. Good morning, Bill.
Oh, good morning, Rod and Sister. I was just going to recommend that it's on YouTube, Rod. Yeah. Sisters Pearls and Mission Girls, and it was shown on Compass. It's all about the St. John of God nuns up in the Beagle Bay.
Yes.
Sisters, Pearls and Mission Girls.
Oh, it's a really wonderful doco. And it was how Bishop Gibney brought the nuns to Australia because the Aboriginal people were being exploited so badly and so badly treated. And that's the thing with the stolen generation. People don't realise the people were stolen. The nuns didn't steal them, but those people speak very highly of the nuns, the old people. I worked up on missions, and when you speak to the old people like Auntie Lizzie and that, they have a lot of love for the nuns because they raised them. You know, they were like their mothers, you know. An Indigenous friend of mine said, you know, his granny had a picture of this nun on her bedroom, cupboard. And, and he said, when he was a little kid, he said, "Who's that, granny?" And she said, "Oh, that's my mummy, you know." So that nun raised it. Yeah,
appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. You can find that on YouTube. And Sister Libby Rogerson, you're familiar with that?
No, I'm not actually. I am familiar with the St. John of God Sisters up and around there. Yes, I am, but not of that doco, no.
Right. Sisters, Pearls and Mission Girls. So who's in charge of an order of nuns? Ultimately, does it go? Obviously, it goes to the Vatican, but maybe on a day-to-day basis, who determines what nuns do, or if you wish to do something, do you have to discuss that with the bishop or the cardinal? Or how does it work?
Well, it's very generally, there's probably two varieties. There are some religious congregations that are predominantly Australia-based, so they were founded here, and they're the sisters, the Good Samaritan Sisters would be one lot, some Mercies are another. And so the person who is in charge of them, sometimes usually called the institute or the congregational leader or whatever, they would be here. The Loreto Sisters are an international order, so the person who is absolutely at the top of ours, if you'd like, in that structure, lives in Rome. She's called she's the institute leader, and then she has four advisors. She lives in Rome, but they travel around all the time, visiting the Loreto Sisters in the number of countries that they're in. And then every country or area, it's often called a province because it might be bigger than a country like ours is. And there is somebody here who's the congregational leader who organises what happens for the Loreto Sisters in the country. And then in our structure, but it isn't everybody's structure, we usually have somebody who's called a community leader. That's the local one, either in the house that you live in or in the area that you're in. Yep.
Do they tell you what to do, what to think? Because there's a lot of women in convents, I'm sure, would have very much have a mind of their own. Is this the situation where you have to do as they say? How much free thought is allowed?
Oh, lots of free thought.
Okay.
I think probably in the past it was much more directive, if you like. But now, my experience anyhow, if you know that your institute leader might want you to do, you know, might want you to do something or have you in mind to do a particular job, they would have a long discussion with you and you would weigh it up and so on and say yes or no. I mean, theoretically, you've taken a vow of obedience, so if they say you've got to go, you've got to go, but that just doesn't happen now.
Sure.
It's a discussion, thought, all those things.
Sister Libby Rogerson is our guest. Owen is next. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Rod. Good morning, Sister.
Morning, Owen.
I had always been curious about, when it comes to turning to the Catholic faith, about the role of saints. And I'd like to ask the sister, how this fits into the light of the nuns. Do nuns have, like, a patron saint, or is each of their monasteries allocated a saint? And what does celebration or acknowledgement of that particular saint mean?
All righty. So saints in the role of the nuns, sister.
No, there's not necessarily a particular allocation of a saint. Some religious congregations are founded by saints. St. Mary MacKillop, who founded the Josephite Sisters here, or St. Ignatius of Loyola, who founded the Jesuits. So they would have a particular affinity with, or whatever you would like to say, that with that particular one. But no, there's no allocation of saints in particular. There was a tradition in the past where sisters and brothers and so on in convents might have had a particular devotion to a saint for some some aspect of their lives or something like that, but no, I don't think that. So in terms of celebration, I think we celebrate the lives of people who are inspirational, have got something to offer the church or society, and we think there's something to look at and emulate and so on.
Sister Libby Rogerson is our guest. 1-300-800-222 is our number. Your chance to ask anything you might want to know about the life of a nun. When my sisters went to school in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, they were taught by nuns. But when my nieces went in the last decade or so, there were no nuns on the staff.
No, that's true.
What has happened in a generation in Australia?
Well, it's a bit more than a generation, but there just is a general decline in people becoming religious. That's religious women and men, for that matter. Why? I think there's all sorts of reasons. One of the reasons is, and particularly in relation to women, there's a lot more things for girls to do now that require generosity and service and all those sorts of things. So I think that's one reason. I think, very basically, much smaller families is another thing.
Sure.
There was a tradition, you know, in as big families, in this is right back in the past, where somebody became a nun or a priest and so on. I think society has changed. It's a much more secular world that we live in now. All of those things have contributed just to decline in numbers. So now, whereas once, you know, we might have had 6 or 8 in a year, we would, you know, get one here or one there or something like that, not the numbers that we had. I think it's also, you have to say, there was a kind of peak in religious life in Australia in the 50s and early 60s. There were huge numbers that joined religious congregations. It was never like that before, and it's never been like it since. So we have a kind of expectation that that's how it always was, but I didn't think it always was like that.
Yeah. So I certainly understand that the options for women in particular are much greater than they were at that peak in the 40s, 50s and 60s. But if it's a vocation, if it's a calling, and you felt that God was asking you to do this, is it the case that young women are not being asked to do it?
Do you know, Rod, I don't know the answer to that. I really don't know that, or whether it's part of a changing world where people are being asked to do other things. And we'll just see. There's a lot of, in my experience, a lot of very idealistic young women who do all sorts of absolutely fantastic things that are of benefit to the world. Mm-hmm. And there's no one to say that God isn't asking them to do that any more than sure. God was asking me to be a nun. But I think we don't have the full answer to that. There's a lot of answers, really. Yeah.
Okay. David in Rockingham in Western Australia says, in Brides of Christ, Sister Catherine is the pivotal point where the church failed to recognise talented females. I was the same age as the students at the generic convent. Tell me about then what happens to women who would like to make a contribution beyond just their own order. Does being a nun allow you to do that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my own Loreto sisters, we've had a sister who was a professor of fine arts. We've had people who've done a whole range of things, have been managers of large organisations to do with social work. Yeah, I think now, well, for a long time, we wouldn't stop anyone doing something that was a great contribution to the world, no.
What about to the church?
And to the church, well, we have people, we've always had people who've taught theology or scripture or been in spiritual directors and so on. So yes, both.
So really. Some people think that some of the church's problems could be solved if there were women priests. Do you think that many nuns want to be priests?
No, not under the present structure. Look, no, I don't think many want to be priests at the moment. I think many might want to be priests in one way, but not in the present structure. It's a very hierarchical structure. It's a very masculine structure. It's not a way that women operate terribly well, to be honest. And so I think, no, I don't think very many nuns want to be priests. I don't know many that do, no.
Sister Libby Rogerson is our guest. Let's take some more calls. Let's talk to Joseph, who's calling from Richmond in Virginia in the United States. Joseph, good morning.
Hello, Mr. Rod, and hello, Sister Libby. What did your students call you? Was it Elizabeth, Sister Elizabeth?
No, they didn't. I've mostly always been Libby, really. Yeah.
Well, I had, because of family trauma, I lived in a Catholic, it was called a Catholic home. It was not for bad kids. It was for kids with a broken home. Yeah. And for 3 years I lived, and I found three people who saved my life, because I was 6, 7, and 8 years old. I didn't think anybody really cared. And I had found three sisters, Sister Vita, which I knew that it meant Sister Life. That was not her actual name, but a Sister Mary Ann and Sister Leonardo, the three nuns who helped me through these difficult, difficult years. They were, to me, they are saints. They've all passed away. I try to keep up with them over the years, but in the U.S., the Catholic Church does not let you find people easily. I don't know what happens in Australia or in Asia, but I tried and tried and tried to find Sister Vita for years after I left that Catholic home, and uh-huh. I couldn't find her. I found out she had health issues. She passed away about 10 years ago, but these are people who really did save my life.
Joseph, well, I appreciate that.
That's very good.
Isn't that beautiful? Joseph, and thanks for listening, and thanks for calling all the way from the USA. Josie is with us as well. Good morning, Josie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. You want to talk about
your, well, the influence fairy nuns have had on your life?
Sister, I'm born in Melbourne and raised in Melbourne from an Italian background. And I come from a very highly religious family on both sides, on my mother's side of the family and on my father, as in my surname side of the family. My great-great-uncle is St. Luigi Guanella. He was canonized in 2011, patron saint of charity, and he's got all his, the convents, all his centres around all the right. world, and the Sisters of Joseph are part of the St. Luigi Guanella Foundation.
Congratulations,
Jessie. Well,
That's fantastic.
Thank you, Sister. Have you heard of St. Luigi Guanella and the Sisters of Joseph who are part of his foundation and centres around the world?
I've vaguely heard of him. I don't know the centres, no.
A lot of saints, yeah.
Right, and my mother's sister was a mother superior. So that's on both sides, because St. Luigi is born in my father's village in Campodocino, up in Lombardia, but my mother's... my mother's side of the family from Sicily, and I want to ask your thoughts. What are your thoughts of the movie The Sound of Music? Because I want to know how authentic is that? And
we might leave it at that, Josie. So, sister, I mean, the connection that most of us have that didn't go to a Catholic school with nuns is seeing them in a movie or on TV. The Sound of Music. Any thoughts on The Sound of Music? It's probably the most famous nun movie of all time.
Yes, it is. Well, actually, it's based on the Von Trapp family. So I think it takes a lot of liberties with the story, but it's true. It's basically true. But she wasn't a nun for very long.
No.
She's only just started, so to speak. So,
but that's a classic example, I suppose, of someone wanting to become a nun and the nuns realising that the convent life was not the best fit for that person, and in fact that they could contribute in a much greater way by doing something else, by becoming a mother.
And that's absolutely true, and that happens quite a lot.
Paul is next. Hello, Paul.
Yes, Rod. My name is Paul, and I've been to Timor Dacau many times. I was at the Australian Catholic University and actually took a science program over there and had the pleasure of meeting two magnificent nuns in Dacau. Have you been to Dacau?
I have, yes. We've got two sisters working there and another two in a village outside of Dacau, yes. So I have been there a couple of times.
And talking about the Sound of Music, the singing of a mass of a Sunday of a morning of the nuns and the girls was just magnificent. Like birds singing every morning. It was a pleasure to go, and a lot of my students had no religious background, not necessarily, but I would take them along for the experience of just hearing the singing. It truly was magnificent. Uh-huh. But I was lucky enough to go to, and my wife and I, to go to the final profession of Sister Natalie in Ballarat a few years ago.
Oh, right. Okay, there we're on familiar ground now. Oh, that was good.
Yeah.
It was an amazing occasion. And again, to go there was like being involved in the sporting team, to see all these nuns coming from all around the world together just to meet one another. And it was a fantastic experience. So congratulations in Dacau in Timor-Leste.
Thank you very much for that, Paul. Sister Libby Rogerson, so tell us about what the nuns are doing in East Timor, Timor-Leste.
Yes, we have one of our Vietnamese sisters who is there with an Australian sister in a village called Garawai, and we have a preschool there, and Sister Margie Burke works with the elderly people there, organising them to go to the doctor, visiting those who are on their own. And then we have two sisters in Bacau. We have some young women there wanting to become religious sisters, very early days, so they work with them. And go with them when they go out into the villages to do some work and help them study and learn English and all those sorts of things. So that's four of them, two in the car, two in the village at the moment. Yeah.
One of our texters says, while current nuns mightn't want to be priests, does your guest think that they might attract more nuns in the future if they were given a more equal role in the Catholic Church, if they could see a less masculine hierarchy to be part of?
That's certainly a possibility, but I don't know the answer to that There's not as many people, not as many men becoming priests either as there were in the past, but certainly I think it could have a greater attraction, but who knows? Yeah.
Tell me how a nun spends her day. What do you do? Is there a typical day, and what's that like?
I'm not sure that there is a typical day. All of us would, at some point in the day, probably usually in the morning, either go to Mass in the morning, or if that's not always possible, then they would pray, usually for about an hour in the morning, meditate, read the scriptures, something like that. And then, other than that, a typical day could be all sorts of things. I mean, I can think of one of our younger sisters who was trained as a physiotherapist. Now, she works probably one day a week or thereabouts in a refugee centre, where she does physiotherapy with refugees. On some other days, she runs programs in a parish or something which is reflecting on the scriptures or so on. She's a spiritual director, so she might meet with somebody who needs guidance in spiritual direction. My typical day might be praying and then getting up and around. At this stage in my life, I spend a good deal of my time working on not-for-profit boards of one sort or another, so I would read the board papers and get ready for the meeting. And then we happen to have two houses where we are, and I live in one house, and I have a family of refugees, a single mother and five children living next door, so I might have a chat with her and with the kids and so on. I'm in the part of the administration of my congregation, which means that I would fly to Melbourne at least once a month or thereabouts and meet and so on. So it would vary greatly from one person to another. We have some elderly sisters, obviously, in nursing homes or something like that, so visiting them would be one of the things we would do in the course of the week. Yep.
Is there active recruiting that goes on? I remember when I was leaving school, you know, the brothers came to talk to, you know, maybe half a dozen of us to ask, you know, whether or not we were thinking about pursuing some sort of life like that. Now, as far as I know, nobody did. But, I mean, do you target certain people at school and approach them and suggest them that maybe they'd be interested in the religious life? Or how do you find the next generation?
No, I don't think we target at all, because partly we're not in the schools now anyhow, but we wouldn't target. Really?
Focus on someone rather than target.
No, well, I don't think that happens now. How do people come to us? By a variety of ways, including via the internet. People who are interested and look up, find out through the internet, through a web page, might come and see us initially. But we do have people who sometimes go around and talk generally in school or in places like that. Yep. But not focusing on any particular individual, which certainly did happen in the past, yeah.
One of the reasons I'm sure people perhaps don't join these days, not to, again, focus on this, is that they look at the sacrifices that you have to make. What are the sacrifices that you have to make to lead a religious life?
Well, I guess not marrying and having a family is one thing. I think not being, as it were, footloose and fancy-free in the single life would be another thing. I think probably less so now, but more in the past was
living in community, not always with people you got on with terribly well, but mm-hmm. learning how to live like that. I guess, I don't know how much of a sacrifice is, but not having your own money, or having much of it anyhow, you know, I mean, we have some money, but not having control over things. And a certain, I guess, in one sense, narrow sense, a lack of freedom about, you know, I can't go out and buy a car tomorrow or build a house or decide I'm going to move somewhere or decide I'm going to travel, or those sorts of things.
Yeah. How much do you get paid? Or, I mean, not looking for a specific dollar amount here, but, I mean, how do you live your daily life and buy things that you might want?
Normally, in terms of cash, you just would work out with your community leader how much cash you might need, and we get it in an account every month. But we also have, we all have credit cards with a certain limit on it,
right,
which we use for the bigger things. But there's usually, there's an accountability, there sure is an accountability. You have to send it, you know, every month with it ticked off of what you bought it for and so on. But, I mean, that's just normal, you know, keeping a track of things like that. So there's much greater freedom about that than there was, which also brings greater responsibility, I might add, about how you use money and what it's for. Yeah.
Do you get holidays? Do you get time where maybe for a couple of weeks a year you don't have to be a nun, so to speak?
Well, I don't know that you don't have to be a nun, but yes, of course we have holidays, yes. Get all sorts and varieties. Some, like some of the sisters, you know, might be two or three of them might go away together down to the beach or something. Others might go with their family. Others, you know, do whatever it is they do. Yeah, but there is time out. There has to be time out.
Sure.
You know? Yeah.
So what about the advantages? What do you see as the advantage of being a nun? Or if not advantage, then some of the great things that you're able to enjoy because you're a nun?
I think the absolute capacity, the primary capacity, is to be able to be of benefit to people if you can. I mean, I can spend my time chatting to my refugee neighbour and her kids, and luckily we're able to provide her with a house or so on, which I couldn't do somewhere else. I'm fairly free to be able to advocate on behalf of refugees and asylum seekers, or in Uluru Statement from the Heart, or whatever it is, and I get enormous satisfaction of being able to do that, and as my primary focus, whereas if I had a husband or children or so on, I could still do it, but not in the same freedom that I have to do it now. Yeah. So I think that's the huge advantage for me, and the huge advantage is working with a lot of people across the way who've committed their lives to making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of our texters said when they were in prison, nuns were there visiting people as well.
Yes, we have a couple of sisters who've been working in the prison ministry for years, and we have one 90-year-old who has just retired after 30 years of teaching in the juvenile justice system. Fantastic, said great farewell. It's amazing. Just year in, year out, quietly teaching all these kids in the prisons to read and write, yeah. Mm. We've had quite a number of sisters engaged in prison ministry of one sort or another, and still have a couple doing it now, yeah.
What do you think are the main misconceptions that people have about nuns?
Misconceptions, I think we're locked up in our chapels all day praying and don't understand, you know, what's happening in the world. I think there are some who think we're so unworldly that we don't really understand the stresses and strains of ordinary life. I think there are misconceptions that we're very regimented and can't think for ourselves. Some of those. But I think a lot of those things have changed too, but there would be still some people who would think that. Yeah.
Sister Libby Rogerson is our guest, and we've got a few minutes left before the news. If you would like to ask her any questions or talk about the life of a nun, or maybe discuss some nuns who may have taught you, is being a nun an important voice for women in the church? How can you make your voice heard?
Well, we do our best. Yes, I think we have an important contribution to make in the life of the church. I think we have a different perspective on it. I think we now have lots and lots of women theologians and scripture scholars and liturgists and so on who do contribute to the life of the church. And I think at all times we're there putting forward that other perspective, that female perspective on life and service and all those sorts of things. And we certainly have sisters very engaged in that. So I think we do have a big contribution to make, actually. Mm. Yeah.
Being part of a community with other women is also important in how convents have evolved and developed over the years. But that must have changed immensely, given that many of those communities are so much smaller than they used to be.
Yes,
is that a good thing or a bad thing, do you think?
I'm not sure that it's either. I think in the past, when there were a lot more people in convents, they were held together by two things, by the fact that they were religious women living together and so on. And they were nearly all focused on the same work, either the same school or the same hospital or the same thing. So that was another thing that connected them together. Now we do a much greater variety of things, and we have very few, that's not the case for all religious congregations, don't have very many of the big houses that we had before. So we tend to have people living in twos or threes or, you know, odd one, there's a couple with, you know, a few more than that in it. And then we have some who live on their own for a whole variety of reasons. I think the development is that it gives people perhaps greater freedom than they had in the past. But it's very difficult. It's a bit like comparing oranges and apples, actually, once when they were all together in the same, doing the same work, whereas that's not the case now. Yeah.
In the old days, you would have had nuns maybe in their late teens, early 20s, living in the same community as women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, up to 80s or 90s. It would have been a remarkable community.
It was a remarkable community. Many cases, isn't it? Because they were very happy, alive places. They were. There's no doubt about that. Yes, they were. And people managed to bridge those divides very well on the whole, yeah. Because I think you have to say that most of the communities that were there, the people who were in them, were all wanting to make life better, not only for the world, but also for the community and so on. A lot of very dedicated women, inspiring women that I've lived with over the years. There's no doubt about that.
Okay. Yeah. Gary is in Cooma. Good morning, Gary.
Yeah, good morning to you both. How are you?
Very well. Do you want to make a point about declining numbers?
Well, not necessarily make a point, just to ask a question.
Yeah.
Myself, perhaps like Libby, you know, I grew up going to church, as not a Catholic church, but church. And one of the interesting things was, you might recall it yourself, Sunday was a day where no shops were open. And Saturday sort of had half days, and Sunday was sort of like devoted to family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have changed, you know, want has become quite a prevalent thing. And as want has unfolded, I have daughters too, by the way, adult daughters, I've raised through all this. And one of the things I'm noticing a lot of is this sort of explosion of me, not we. And people with compassion and wisdom, and people like Libby who devote their life to being we people, probably see and experience the byproduct of this more, and that's declining numbers perhaps. But, you know, one of the interesting things is, as she said, there's a lot of good people who devote their life and have purpose, and their purpose, as they've seen it, as it's unfolded, as it's been given to them, has been to do wonderful things. There's still a lot of people who do that. But there's a lot of people, too, who are very obsessed now with me and not we.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll get Libby to comment on that. Thanks very much for that, Gary. Libby.
Yes, I think that, look, I think part of the issue is growing affluence. I think when we become very affluent, we can sometimes become very focused on making more money or getting more things and forgetting about the wider community and how we might contribute. I'm sure that has some contribution to declining numbers in whatever religious denomination you happen to belong to. Yes, it's a much more secular world. I think there is much more greed than there was, because, but that's reflective of probably Australia and the Western world rather than the wider world, really.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Just before we go, tell me about the influence you've had on, you know, maybe a generation or more of young women. When they come to you for advice, when you've led a very different life to the way or the lives they are leading, how do you advise them? What do you tell them?
I think I'd be more likely to listen than actual give advice, really. Sometimes there is advice that can be given. But in the really profound things that challenge and maybe upset or things, that we all share the human condition. We're all caught up, whether we're a nun or not a nun, caught up in those big things that challenge our lives and so on. So I think primarily I'd be listening rather than giving advice. Mm-hmm. If advice is sought, then I'd give it if I knew what I was talking about. Really.
What yeah. advice would you give somebody who was thinking about becoming a nun, or maybe had a daughter or granddaughter who was thinking about becoming a nun?
I would have a chat with them about why it is they thought that was the case. I might tell them, give them something that I thought was good to read or look at or so on. I would keep the conversation going. I would then suggest that they go and talk to somebody in the congregation who is responsible for the training of religious, so that they might talk to them a bit more. I'd invite them home for dinner and have a few more chats about it. Yeah.
You'd want to make sure that there was a good cook in the convent.
I don't think you need worry about that.
Really?
No. I think you're all right. I think we'll find enough good cooks among us. Yeah. Yeah.
Sister Libby Rogerson, I appreciate the fact that you've got up so early for us this morning and talked to us about the religious life for so long, and I thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Ron. Okay.
Thank you. Sister Libby Rogerson, who is a Loreto nun and who very kindly gave us her time this morning. And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.